Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from May 27, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Arahant Sutta, where the Buddha explains in a very succinct way, in one paragraph, the process of awakening. There's a related article on the website, and if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. So today's talk is on the Arahant Sutta, where the Buddha describes the process of awakening in a single paragraph. The Buddha's words. Let me preface this. If five clinging aggregates is something that I talk about often, I know it's confusing for many, mostly because of the nomenclature, I think, more than anything else. And so the easiest way to look at the five clinging aggregates is that the five clinging aggregates describe the personal experience of ongoing confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. The components are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And those are simply observable facts that we all use to define ourselves, first as a physical body, then by through feeling. You know, we like something, we don't like something, we have a physical sensation, and we start defining a self by that. We create perceptions based on what's occurring in our life, what we like and dislike. That leads to fabrications or assumptions about ourselves in relation to the world. And ultimately, that all of that affects our ongoing consciousness. So five clinging aggregates describe the personal experience of suffering. And if you think about it in that way, if I ever get to actually reading the sutta, you can see why the Buddha is addressing the five clinging aggregates and addressing them in a way that once you understand the nature of suffering and your own contributions to it, or another way that the Buddha would often describe suffering is that we join with it. We cling to suffering because we create an identity over the things that create dukkha. It helps clarify what the Buddha is teaching here. So, the Buddha's words. And when one has seen the five clinging aggregates as they really are, the arising and the passing away, understanding the attraction and the distraction, seeing the arising of desire and the continued delusion, and being delivered from the five clinging aggregates, this one is released from clinging. All defilements are destroyed. What must be done has been done. Perfection is attained. The burden has been put down. The highest goal attained. This one is liberated by perfect insight. And of course, perfect insight means seeing things clearly. And so the Buddha didn't teach this generalized insight that is very common today, that we should be almost micro-focus on everything that's occurring and see the insight in all these things. The most important insight we can gain is the insight into the impermanence of what we think is me, what we call, this is me and I'm trying to establish a permanent self where it can't be established. And how that relates to the five clinging aggregates and to the sutta is every one of those aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness, if you look at clearly and impersonally, you recognize that they're all impermanent. So why insist that this impermanent body is me? Because I can't maintain it for even a split second. We know that every moment, even the human body, this thing that we insist is a permanent me, changes. Every single moment there's atoms, the Buddha called them kalapas 2,500 years ago. There's atoms and subatomic particles that come into existence and blink out of existence in the blink of an eye. And that's occurring within our bodies. So even on a practical level, this is always changing. I can't identify myself with that. And of course, our feelings and our views about things, how we see ourselves in relation to the world, especially to the people that are closest to us. Yesterday, I had an argument with my spouse. Today, she's the most wonderful person in the world. I don't have a spouse right now, but she's Bodhi. Yesterday, Bodhi was awful. Today, my dog is just the most perfect dog in the world. Our perceptions change about how we feel about things and in relation to what we're joining to. What we think is most important, what we're using to define ourselves. That's the five clinging aggregates. When the Buddha is talking about the burden has been put down, what's the burden? The burden is maintaining this self-referential ego self. It's the whole burden. It's the whole problem. And when we can let go of the burden, when we can finally put the burden down, we live our lives in lasting peace and happiness, because we're no longer feel the need to defend something that is indefensible, because there's nothing there. It's like foam on the ocean. There's nothing there to defend. There's another line I wanted to mention here. Seeing the five clinging aggregates as they really are, the arising and the passing away. This relates to what we developed on retreat in the last couple of talks last week on becoming. In dependent origination, what the Buddha awakened to, he describes the process of becoming, and it's often unmodified in the translations, meaning the modification of that word is up to us. So what does he mean by that? Ultimately, what it's pointing out to is what we hold in mind is going to determine what we're going to become in the next moment. And if what we hold in mind is framed or developed through the Eightfold Path, then what we will become in the next moment is we'll become ever increasingly more awakened. But if we disregard the Eightfold Path or haven't had the good fortune to encounter it, what we will become will be rooted in ignorance, and we can only become more ignorant and have more experience. And again, I'm not talking about we're ignorant of every single thing in the world. We're ignorant of the Four Noble Truths, the true nature of human life in the world. And of course, anything that we're ignorant of, we can't hope to achieve any kind of satisfaction in it. If I set out today to go cut the front lawn and I'm ignorant of how to start the lawnmower, it's going to be a very unsatisfactory day, isn't it? If I set out today to develop a calm, peaceful mind in relation to how I'm living my life, but I don't understand how to get it going, I can't expect to have that, can I? And again, that's what the Buddha talks about becoming. That's what the Buddha is referring to here. To understand the process that we engage in that maintains either confusion, troubled thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences, or what we're going to hold in mind to become more awakened. And that's what this little sutta points to. The sutta was given to a group of senior monks and nuns that had already developed a well-developed understanding of the Buddha's Dhamma. So it's not something that the Buddha threw out there and thought people should just understand it. In the context, it made perfect sense. He was fine-tuning a group of folks that already had a good understanding of the Dhamma, just like you all do. I did mean it a little bit flippantly. But just to point out that if we can understand these few basic concepts that the Buddha's teaching, and that's really the whole point of his teaching, to understand these things, then we can apply them in the way that they're meant to be applied, rather than simply being confused by something called the five clinging aggregates because we don't know what they mean. You know, we do. A simple inquiry will develop it. One of the aspects of ignorance is that a self-referential ego self insists on ignoring anything that would challenge its own ignorance. And so even something like five clinging aggregates, our minds start closing down. We get cloudy. You know, we don't want to accept it. That's your self-reference, Debbie. That's a self-reference ego self saying, I need to ignore this because it challenged my own ignorance. You know, we don't want to open the book and look at it. And that's a good point of reference when you're struggling with aspects of the Dhamma. It doesn't mean to try harder, though, because you can get very frustrated. Just recognize. You know, some people get really caught up in dependent origination because it gets a little bit intricate. And it's hard to follow now from my point of view, not because I'm some great awakened master, but now when I look at dependent origination, it's so obvious and simple to me. But I remember a time, and it lasted for a long time, when I'd go over these 12 simple steps and I just couldn't apply it in a meaningful way. I just didn't have the context yet in my own mind to see it. And that's really how the Dhamma works. That's the awakening experience. We understand something that at one time seems so confusing and so clouded from our own understanding. And when we see it, it's like, wow, it's so simple. There it is. But until we understand it, we don't know how to start the lawnmower. Can't get the lawn cut. So that's the end of the talk today. Any questions directly related to the sutta? And then we'll go around the room. All right. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good
how
morning.
Are you? Good morning.
Great talk, John. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very glad to be here. I was thinking about how impermanence is even part of a bigger picture than ourselves, like how nature is always changing and we're just a part of that cycle.
Yeah.
And coming here, I was starting to get a tinge of anger about why is it that I have to have such bad allergies every time this year? Like, my eyes are itchy and they hurt and I feel congested. And I thought, well, that's because things are pollinating.
Okay.
You know, like my car has this beautiful sheen of green when I go to the and the bees are part of that and we're all part of that.
Yeah.
And if my suffering is that little piece of nature perpetuating itself, you know, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And then we get all these great flowers and everything from the pollination process, and then it all dies. But it doesn't really die, it just goes dormant.
Yeah.
And that's nature's way of protecting itself again. And we're affected by that. I mean, we could put on clothes and survive it, but we get a little bit down and a little bit tired in the winter, and then we become more resilient. And when spring comes again, we're a little happier. So we're part of that, we're really part of that chain.
Yeah.
And isn't it how amazing how everybody in the world drops off from 6 to 6 or 8 or 10 hours? Like, what's that about?
Yeah.
You know, that's just our body's protecting itself.
Yeah.
And we can't. And Jon Kabat-Zinn always says, if you're breathing, there's more right than you than wrong.
Yeah.
And how true is that? Yeah. Because all these organs and things are working to keep you alive, and we have nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
If I had to control my breathing, I would have been dead a long time ago.
Yeah.
So there's a great choreography of things happening that are all changing, and we're all a big, larger part of that. And when we can come to understand that, the little things, the feelings, the thoughts, the emotions, really are so insignificant.
Yeah. Wow, thank you. What a great word to use to describe it, choreography. You know, and we're the choreographer. we're in charge, not in charge of what's occurring, but we're in charge of how we experience it by the quality of our mind. If our mind is at peace with what's occurring, with the pollen being blown around and all the other things, we're able to not get fixated on, I wish my eyes weren't so uncomfortable right now.
You
and
too.
See the incredible, well, I'm using you as the example. We miss the incredible, I don't even want to use the word beauty, but it's pretty magnificent. We miss the incredible nature of life unfolding. And it's not always, the reason why I said I shouldn't use, it's not always beautiful. And there's some aspects that create dis-ease in ourselves. But the overall process is just remarkable. And that's what we're here to be mindfully present with, the ongoing process.
Yeah, when you can look at the bigger picture of things, you don't worry so much about the little things.
Yeah, especially while you stop taking things personally. You stop seeing things from a self-referential point of view. That what you're describing also is, now the word for it is spaciousness. We're seeing a much bigger picture than just what's happening to me in this moment. There's great freedom in that. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. Jen, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you too. I like what Anthony said because it reminded me of my same. I'm also struggling with the allergies, and I remember yesterday I was like, I had this moment where I was really like, it was, you know, I was very uncomfortable, and I was trying to have an important conversation with my husband, and he was like, "Are you okay?" I was like, "It's just my allergies. It'll pass." And like just that kind of approach to things, you know, it'll pass is sort of my kind of gentle reminder that of things being impermanent.
Yeah.
And I feel like saying it'll pass is more of a relatable thing for people to understand rather than saying, you know, it's impermanent. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you, Anthony, just reminded me of that. Because I've definitely been, I know there's some judgment of myself. I know in here, I know I can see that. I can see that there's some, you know, fear, anxiety about, and some resistance to some of the things I think that I learned or that it kind of got in during retreat, where I'm seeing, you know, seeing that my thoughts and my thinking and my stories are really very comfortable place for me to be. It's a real tendency for me to be in my head, and how much of that I've let go, but it sort of feels like there's like another layer here that is kind of I'm breaking through of letting go of stories and kind of streams of consciousness. And it feels like kind of like you were saying fog, there's like a fog. Kind of feels like, you know, I can sort of see the next layer of peace, but I'm still a little resistant to fully letting go of thinking about stuff and that comfort zone.
That's a great recognition, too. But you're recognizing the need to ignore what's right there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only thing to do is to recognize it and be at peace with that. And
right.
And impermanence helps so much with that because
yeah.
you know
yeah.
that
yeah.
you're not stuck in this.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha described, I remember on a retreat, the Nagara Sutta, how he got stuck in that self-referential feedback loop,
mm-hmm.
but how he continued and he was able to break through that.
Yeah.
Like foam on the ocean. There's really nothing there except it seems real.
I think that's what the impermanence has been very helpful in that regard because it helps me see that the story is not the way to go.
Yeah.
That's not where to put my energy because the story is impermanent.
Yeah, and just like the five aggregates that we use to describe a self, recognize the impermanence of every one of them, and it helps so much in letting go of these, the live stream that's going on in our head.
Right.
You know, it's so hard to get out of it because that is our reference point. What the story we keep telling ourselves is who we think we are. And the Dhamma, the Buddha saying, no, that's a wrong view. That's anatta. Let go of those views. And it really is a discursive feedback loop that we get caught up in. I think you've all had this experience that a completely discrete experience feels like something that it's not even related to, but yet we're having the same reaction to it. That's the feedback loop that's clouding everything that we're experiencing because we need to ignore anything that would challenge that view.
Mm-hmm.
Glad you're here. Tommy, good to see you this morning.
Good morning, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Just happy to be here, happy to continue on the journey, trying to, add in components to create a little relaxation in my life and trying to be better connected. And it's a process. I mean, it ebbs and flows and ebbs and flows,
yeah.
And sometimes I feel closer to some kind of serenity and sometimes I feel further from it, but certainly it's an improving journey. So I'm just happy to be here and trying to get back into it. The back and forth between my job and working and trying to be here and try to attach myself to some consistency is a challenge.
Yeah.
But I'm trying.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's always good to see you, Tommy. It is. When you're in a few different places, and that's difficult. I don't know if you noticed, and I'm just using a new platform too, that the classes are streamed and my Wednesday noontime talk is streamed live, and you have the ability to interact or ask some questions or comments too. So, and that's on the website at the time.
Great.
Yeah, so, good. Good to see you. Eva, good morning. How are you?
John, very good to be here. Hi. I feel that I've reached wonderful and special places in meditation, and I feel very joyful at the ability to face certain things and realize that they are impermanent and have a way to deal with it. However,
there's always one of those.
Yes, there's this big dark spot which has to do with my mother and my relationship and our conditioned interactions, and
yeah.
I have not been able to deal with it. She has dementia, so now I spend more time with her, and the anger is shameful. I'm shocked at how vibrant it still is.
Mm.
And so,
la 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 la, it's all good.
And then, wow, I can't get over it. I can't,
yeah.
You know, I leave there and I'm so angry and frustrated. And then it passes and I'm better, you know.
Yeah.
But then I know I have to go back there. And it's like, oh God, you know, how am I going to deal? Okay, I'm going to be better this time. I'm not going to let it bother me. It just happens again. But other than that, I just...
Yeah. Thank you. That what you're describing is an extreme example of the first noble truth, and that suffering occurs and it's exacerbated by us wanting a situation to be different. And it's hard when your mom is going through something like that and reacting. My mom developed dementia. And it took her almost 10 years to finally die with some other things. And she went from the sweetest person you've ever met, when I think about it, I always cry, to in the early stage, just incredibly full of anger and striking out and saying things that she never said before, but that's just part of it. But it's hard, even knowing it, I remember, I knew this wasn't my mother, it was something else. But even knowing it, at least initially, doesn't help at all. You're stuck in it. And when you're in it, it's just awful. But like you said, you can remove yourself from it and get a little clarity on what's occurring. And I was eventually able to frame it within the Eightfold Path and understand it for what it was and not take it so personally. But that's, you know, easy to say now, but it was just awful. You know, it just was. So the only real solution is to understand that the mind states that are generated are impermanent and to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. Because that was really what got me through it, is recognizing that when I'm in it, I shouldn't even expect my mind to be at peace, but I could be at peace with that mind state, you know. And it was important, at least to a certain point. It was important. I felt it was important for my mom to have me there in her presence once in a while. You know, I could see a difference in her. So you do it. So, but I know what you're going through. It's tough. Think about the thing that I can even remember now, walking out of their house, and just feeling so fortunate that I have a practice that I can really take refuge in, you know, instead of, you know, what I would, in the past I would have went to the closest gin mill. Thank you. I'm glad you're here this morning, Mary. Good to see you this morning. How are you?
You're good. You know, I know I've learned through this class to kind of be like feathers on a duck's back and just let it all walk. It's taking this has helped me a great deal in dealing with a lot of stuff. But when I, you know, feel a sorrowful feeling, I just let it come and know that it will pass.
Yeah.
And don't fight it, and not to fight people. I mean, when people, and then I had an altercation with my sister the other day. It was like when we were kids again, and she was throwing a temper tantrum when she was, you know, 66 years old. And I just let it happen.
Yeah.
And there's no point. I'm not going to change that. I'm not going to change that. Just let it happen and move on. And you know, unfortunately, she carries a great big chip on her shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel badly that she's like that, but let it go, and she needs to let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And isn't it remarkable that we can just be at peace with less than peaceful mind states when an appropriate feeling like sorrow comes up? As long as we can recognize that we're not stuck in it, it makes it easier to just be at peace with it.
I mean, a year ago, you couldn't have told me that.
Yeah.
That sorrow was going to get better, but gee, look at that! It does. It gets better. It comes less frequently, and you know, it doesn't last as long.
You know, when you're in it, though, it feels like it's kind of, especially when you don't have a perspective, it feels like this is the way I'm going to feel forever.
Yeah.
And then it becomes intolerable, doesn't
yeah.
it? but when we can recognize the impermanence of anything. And also the other side of that, when something occurs that makes us feel like, you know, we're on top of the world, it gives us the perspective to not get overblown about even that. And look, this is a temporary state.
Although it's easy to, it's very easy to do that. I
mean, oh, yeah.
That, you know, we see that in people all the time.
Yep. And that we start clinging to anything that's impermanent because it's generated something. And even that an aversion to sorrow is an aspect of clinging, isn't it? You know, it's just the other side of it because of a reaction to it. And then we get to see things clearly. It doesn't, you're describing, it doesn't, this is something that people have an aversion to in the Dhamma when they start getting the ramifications or understanding the ramifications of this, and they feel like it's going to turn me into a robot and I won't feel anything. What it brings is the ability to feel everything deeply without overreacting to anything. And that's what I see when I describe awakening as full human maturity. That's how a mature person acts. You're able to be fully engaged in whatever you're doing without the need for it to be any different. And then you can really be present. And you're able to be present with your mom, even though it's an awful situation, and all these other things, you know, that occur in life. We can just simply be present with it without the need for it to be any different. And ultimately, that filters down to how we see ourselves. And maybe I have to say it should start there. That we're able to accept ourselves, no matter what's occurring, understanding that this too shall pass.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mary. It's good to see you. That'd be good to see you this morning.
Good to see you too. This has been really helpful, this discussion. Taking in a lot. And it's helping me integrate things, you know, and how important it is for me to come here on Saturday morning after my week, just kind of as a replenishing reminder, renewal, you know, to get it in, you know. And just wanted to say something about what Eve said, is that I think often it's harder to accept. You were saying to accept, you know, it's in our mind. That it's harder when it's an emotion like anger, like you used the word shameful, like there it is, the judgment already, you know, that the anger is harder for some reason, you know, to just accept that this is where I'm at, you know, like Jen was saying, you know, that it's impermanent, then it passes away, but it's harder to go there with anger, you know, it's like, we want to judge ourselves for feeling, you know, because it doesn't feel good, because, you know, we don't want to hurt anybody. If we, you know, what I'm learning is so often, if I just accept that I'm angry, okay, then it will, I know it's impermanent and it will go away, just like when I feel sick and I want to think that, oh my God, I'm getting flu, or oh my God, this, instead I'm just trying to say, okay, I feel this way right now, just right now.
Yeah.
You know, and then let it go. So those kind of things are a little bit harder in my struggle. I also love what Anthony said about the nature, and I really like that in thinking about your allergies in terms of this bigger choreography, really takes the eye making out of it. And okay, it's not about me, you know, and I'm trying to integrate that in terms of my relationship with my spouse, that she, when she's really struggling, my job, you know, I always want to fix it, I want to help people, and it's hard to see her in pain and to accept that I can be there for her in a loving way, but I can't make it better always.
Yeah.
It makes me sad, you know, it's like, cause she's in pain and struggling, and so that's the impermanence that's hard too, you know, like I'm just, it's not about me. It's just about sitting with someone and being kind and gentle with myself and her, and, you know, seeing it in the bigger picture, you know. So that was really helpful. I tend to see things in the bigger picture with nature, but it's helping me see it in the bigger picture in relationship, too.
Yeah. Because, everything is part of nature.
Yeah.
But we can get really micro-focused on, we're, you know, in a sense, we're all caretakers, especially of people that are closest to us. We want to take care of them. And that can lead us to start feeling like we know better, we know how other people should be living their life. And even if it's obvious, it's still coming from a self-referential point of view rather than a realistic point of view.
Especially when you're awakened.
Oh, well, moving towards it, certainly. Yeah. Once you get there, once you get there, you don't give a damn about what's going on.
Terrible. Yeah.
But yeah, we and those feelings of anger,
I know better, 'cause I know the anger
come up from that a lot of times because this person, if they could just do it, why can't they?
Just meditate and then study the Eightfold Path.
The Buddha even talks about shame, but a proper use of shame. Just use it to recognize that there's something occurring that is hurtful towards you and others, but not to beat yourself up about it. So what you're describing, Debbie, is a developing understanding of, and it's an important and profound understanding, the difference between acceptance and approval. So we accept what's occurring for the simple reason that it's occurring, even in other people. That doesn't mean we have to approve of it. But in a self-referential ego self gets those two things together. Because you think about it. In order for me to accept it, I have to approve of it first. Well, there's not very much that we can approve of. And that we even need to approve of. In fact, I would say the only thing we need to approve of is whether we're engaged in the Eightfold Path or not. Because that's going to deliver us that peace that allows us to be much more effective in our own lives for ourselves and for others. Rather than feeling like we have to be caretakers for the entire world. Look at the reaction that occurs, good or bad. It all kind of arises from people feeling they know how other people should be. And you know, we start one-on-one conflicts and we start wars over that, don't we? I don't want to even talk about that today. So, thank you, Debbie. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Hasn't been a word that's wasted in this time.
I agree. It's really, really remarkable.
Thank everybody for showing up and saying what they needed to say. It's been great. Your run through of the five clinging aggregates right at the beginning of your talk, I can always identify myself with every one of them. And sometimes they get stuck with super glue. Onto me, you know, you say the stuff that you stick them to yourself, and I think sometimes I get stuck with super glue. I can't see a gap between, you know, I just can't see out of them.
Right.
I can't see around them, I can't see out of them. I just look at life through the five clinging aggregates, what I'm feeling, this should be as it is, and all the things that people have spoken about this morning. And I think in the sutra, I can't remember the exact word, but you said towards the end you are released or combined, you know, from the...
Put the burden down.
Put the burden down. That's another one, yeah. I don't know if anybody else has thought of this, but if I was in the Buddha's shoes and I knew that I needed the key to seeing and understanding the suffering of everybody. That must be, in a way, a burden in itself. Meaning, I mean, if you could, not to get religions and everything else crossed over, I'm not doing that, but you hear of another, you know, people of laying on hands and they can see again, or put the hands on somebody they can hear and they, you know, the legs better, they don't walk the legs, whatever. I mean, that's in a physical sense. But if you could have the key to understand the problems of what everybody else, and when you think about detail that the Buddha would see life, you know, in firing everything, and, you know, everything you hear is fire, everything you see is fire, and seeing it so clearly in everybody. Because you're the only one in the world like this. You know, that's almost a burden in itself, and no wonder he taught to the last breath in his body. He was still teaching the Dharma, because I think he understood. You know.
Yeah.
In a sense, although he's called enlightenment and putting the burden down and... I think you must pick up another one as well, you know, somewhere on the line.
Yes and no. So when the Buddha awakened, he described suffering as birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, not getting what is desired is suffering, getting what is undesired is suffering. And then he would always conclude by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. And upon that profound understanding, he also understood that suffering is a consequence of living in the world, and that we exacerbate that by wanting the conditions of the world to be different than they are. And awakening means to understand that whole process, and that you don't want it to be any different than it is, because it can't be. It doesn't mean that you don't have an inner, I can't even call it desire, that someone else is not suffering, because we understand where it comes from. So I don't know that he picked up another burden upon his awakening. He just simply saw things clearly. And what that means, to me, a burden would be wanting something to be different than it is. So when I see someone suffering, you know, because of the way I'm living my life now, I encounter a lot of people that want to talk to me about their suffering. But I don't take on the burden anymore. Years ago, I would. In fact, I was involved in early in recovery. One of the things you do in recovery is you try to help other people. But early in recovery, I would often take on other people's burdens, and I'd be worried that they're going to go out and drink and drug, and I'd lose sleep over it, and this and that. And there's kind of a subtle manipulation within that community anyway. Now, I'm much more attuned to what people are going through, but I don't need them to be any different than they are. I don't need their disease to be any different than they are. And again, I'm not describing myself as some great awakened being, but I've been able to develop a pretty profound measure of peace with most people in the world, you know, simply because that's the way it is. I understand that's the nature. And I also notice that I'm much more mindfully present with people. I don't have an aversion when people start describing some pretty severe levels of suffering or even aggressive behavior. Where in the past I would immediately, people say things to me that in the past I would judge them very harshly and I wouldn't be able to stay present with them. And now I just see it as part of that process of being stuck in deluded thinking. So I don't mean to argue. You bring up a very good point. So the Buddha was profoundly engaged with the suffering of his time. And most people came to him because of suffering. So even the kings and the leaders, you know, would come to him because of describing the nature of suffering. And I'm sure he felt it. In fact, I know he felt it, but it didn't affect the quality of his mind. And that's really what a burden is, you know, when it affects the quality of our mind. Jen?
So what... the way that I'm thinking about it, and I'm not sure if this is right, is that there's I making it being burdened. Because I have to be burdened. It's happening to me. This thing is my burden.
Yep.
Right?
When you're identifying, when you're joined with the suffering.
Yeah. I understand it, but
you will, but it really comes down to that idea of between acceptance and approval,
right.
And it's hard for it's. We feel like we're losing control, or almost like we're being selfish if we don't judge something as right or wrong and put those labels on it. But that really limits our response, because we inherently know, and in fact. I was describing this to an online student the other day. When you fully enter, when you start developing the Eightfold Path, the great freedom that it brings is because you know that if your behavior is framed by that, you're not causing harm for others, and you're doing your utmost best to bring, literally, to bring peace and harmony into the world, because you're not contributing to it. And there is great freedom in understanding that this is how I'm living my life now. You don't have to second judge yourself or your motives. Because you have something to see your motives and your intentions very clearly. I remember you told me early on that you were, because of right speech, you were able to notice your behavior in relation to that very clearly. Many people say just that when they first come to the Dhamma, and that's, again, that's how it's, that's why it's there.
Well, I think what you're saying, and I know what Debbie was saying, what Lauren was saying about, you're saying that with students now, you're able to be objective, essentially, not take personally what they're saying, or no, or decide that you know what they need to do, and then you're putting them on a trajectory that's what you think is, there's our making in that. I can see that. I appreciate that. I've experienced that with teaching with my students, but I think, and it must have to do with my own identity and how I identify with the people that are closest to me. That's where that knowing, feeling like I know what's best, that piece is really, as soon as I see it within myself, it's like all I can do is just stop talking.
But that's an aspect of right speech, isn't
it?
I mean, it truly is. When you feel like what you have to say is going to have no impact, it's wrong speech to keep going. It really is, because then you're just isolating someone. You're pushing someone into a corner. They may never listen to you again.
Right.
You know, we've all had that experience. It gets
but
very
what you
frustrating.
Said about when you get on those trajectories of I know better, then you close yourself off to all the possible solutions.
Yeah, in my own case, I do know better. I know that if people would just take to the Eightfold Path, they're going to have.
Same.
But I also know that not many people are going to do it.
Right,
and in most situations, it's really foolish of me to say, you know, everything's going to be fine with you. Meditate and develop the Eightfold Path. For one thing, initially those people are going to never talk to me again because they're going to. Rightly classify me as an idiot because it's idiotic to say that in that situation.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. And so everything is a situation. And when we can be mindfully present and understand, again, the framework of the Eightfold Path, what's right speech in this? What can I say right now that is going to have the most significant impact? And if the mindful response is, there's nothing I can say, with the Buddha. The Buddha spent a great deal of the time, people would ask him questions and he would sit here just like that to signify there's no answer to the question you're asking, or at least no meaningful answer. You know, and it's okay to keep our mouth shut.
And isn't it true that if you try to convince somebody, you're putting them on the path to actually rejecting it?
Absolutely.
Like if I were to say to my wife, you have to meditate, that would be the last thing in the world she'd ever try.
Yeah, that's right.
But
or anybody else.
But leading by example, you know, if she sees the positive benefits in me, or, you know, comes across different things that I'm doing and happens to be interested, then maybe she'll lead down that path, maybe not. But I think trying to convince somebody your opinion is the right one is the biggest way to turn them off.
Never works, no matter how right you are.
Thank you,
Anthony. Ellie, it's good to see you. How have you been?
Okay.
Good.
You know, your first question about, you know, how is the quality of your mind? And I realize that that's really the key to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it might be something I try to do is ask myself that every day. Because, like, when I'm meditating and a thought carries me way down a path, then I get completely lost. I feel like in my life I've gone way down a path, trying to control things, in fact, driving here, I was also thinking of choreography, but I was realizing that I was trying to choreograph.
Yeah.
Not just my life, but my family's life. You know, everyone's home for the summer, and no one's who they were before, including us.
Yeah, well.
You know, we've been without kids at home, which is really liberating. And they've been doing their own thing, so we're not fitting back together same way, and we should be, and we can't, but we're not figuring it out. It's not working. And, you know, kids are struggling, and I want to fix them, and I'm realizing, you know, I'm trying to kind of mastermind this whole dynamic that's real burden that I need to just, you know, somehow put aside and not put all my energy into that, because it's you know, not setting myself up for success, obviously, that's not going to happen. So, you know, I forgot completely about the quality of my mind. I mean, my mind's just been a mess. So I think if I can just remember to ask myself that question every once in a while, it'll bring me back to the realization of, you know, where my mind is and, you know, how to pull it back to a kind of healthier place. So that's my goal.
Thank you. I'm so glad you're here. That is, I mean, the whole point of awakening is to develop that quality of mind that the Buddha described as calm.
Right.
And the word he would use is unbound or released, as an unbound or release from craving and clinging, wanting the people, our family, or the events of our lives to be any different than it is. And, you know, as far as that goes, the only thing we can really do, I think, as a parent, I'm talking about someone who's never been a parent, so take it with that, is to create a place that is safe, you know? And maybe I'm saying it because that's how I was just a wild, kind of mean little kid because I was very unhappy with life. But I always felt that my home was a place of safety, and that my parents, it was important for them that I felt that way, and they made all of us feel that way. So maybe that's why I'm saying this. But that, I realize now that that's really all you can do. And you can't do much more than that. Why? Because the Buddha tells us that dukkha is going to occur. And people are going to come back into our children will come back into our house. And they're all going to be different. And there's going to be this. As long as they feel safe, you've done your part. So. I'm glad you're here today. Isaiah, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to see you. I'm good.
How's your practice going?
It's better. I find that I'm able to myself more from, well, I don't know if I'm able to remove myself, but I'm able to be able to sit with what I'm feeling.
Yeah, that's outstanding.
To, you know, distracting myself from, and I've been able to sit for longer and really enjoy it. I don't yet time myself. I just sit for like as long as I feel.
That's great. I mean, you don't need to time yourself. You know, the only thing I would say about that is don't push yourself too far. You know, but it doesn't sound like you are. It sounds like you've developed a very comfortable meditation practice. So, good for you. Are you reading the book?
Yeah.
Good. Like, any questions about that? Just, you know, always feel free to contact me. But I'm glad you're here this morning. It was a great class. It really is. The sangha that's developed here in all three. It's interesting that, with the exception of Lorna, who comes to Tuesday night, the each three classes have developed almost as their own separate sanghas, but we're all kind of developing the Dhamma in a very significant way. And you know, if you listen to the talks, I get so many comments from online students that can't find the sangha. They get so much out of what we talk about here, and it really is remarkable how well focused we are. You've all contributed to a true refuge right here in good old Frenchtown. So thank you for that. A few quick announcements and we'll finish with Meta. We are going to have our first annual Cross River Meditation Center picnic. I think July, it's going to be at Morris House, who's got a beautiful property just over the river with a nice pool and all that stuff. It's going to be, I think the Saturday after the 4th of July is the 7th, with the rain date that Sunday, so July 7th or 8th. Open to everyone, you know, obviously Sangha members or family, friends, cats and dogs, horses, goats, and potbelly pigs. you know, like a potluck kind of thing. And I'll put the info in an email hopefully this week, but I would probably going to start around 1 o'clock, and it's going to be fun. And you'll get to meet some of the other members of the different. We're all one sangha, but the people that come on different nights other than Saturday, too, and that'll be fun. It's nice when we do that on retreat, too. The pictures from our retreat 2 weeks ago are up, and the talks, there really, really was great discussions there, too. And the registration for our October retreat, if you decide you're going to go, please sign up as soon as possible, because it helps my logistics greatly. And also, there's if you want a single room or a bed in a quad room, those go the quickest. There's only three beds, three single rooms for the women, three single rooms for the men, and two quad rooms for each. See, in other words, there's four beds and a quad room for women and four beds and a quad room for men. So if you want to sign up early, I hope you can join us again on this retreat. Any questions or comments about today's class? Lingering. Great. All right, we'll finish with the Buddha's words on metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. Give me a moment. So metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an aspiration for an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Have a great holiday. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.